Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Governor Kathy Hochul is moving to ban local police departments from formal cooperation agreements with ICE. But immigration advocates say the proposal doesn't go far enough and are calling for broader protections under the New York for All Act. We'll talk with one advocacy group later. After Governor Shapiro's budget address in Pennsylvania, the questions are already starting. Spotlight PA Capitol reporter Stephen Caruso breaks down the key takeaways. Why New York State says neighbors and households play a critical role in emergencies, and a free training program aims to help New Yorkers feel less overwhelmed and more prepared when disasters strike. Plus, a new space for creativity, wellness, and connection opening in Ellenville. We'll meet the founders of Juniper and hear how they hope to build community after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, says he will draw down about 700 federal immigration officers from Minnesota. That will still leave some 2,000 officers in the state. Homan spoke to reporters last hour in Minnesota. He says these cuts come after unprecedented cooperation with state and local law enforcement officials. But Homan had this warning.
Again, a complete drawdown is going to depend on cooperation, continued cooperation of local and state law enforcement, and the decrease of the violence, the rhetoric, and the attacks against ICE and Border Patrol.
However, it has been federal agents who have killed two Minneapolis protesters. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem falsely claimed that protesters Renee Macklin Good and Alex Preddy were domestic terrorists. Today, Homan said the rhetoric, which he said was aimed at federal agents, is what's leading to bloodshed. The man found guilty of trying to kill then-presidential candidate Donald Trump in Florida in 2024 will be sentenced today. NPR's Greg Allen reports prosecutors are seeking a life sentence for Ryan Ruth.
A Secret Service agent spotted Ryan Ruth holding a rifle in the tree line at a golf club in West Palm Beach where Trump was golfing and fired on him. Ruth fled and was arrested a short time later. Prosecutors detailed Ruth's movements in the weeks leading up to the planned sniper attack. Ruth represented himself at the trial. The jury deliberated just 2 hours before finding him guilty on all counts. When the verdict was read, he attempted to stab himself in the neck with a pen before being subdued by federal marshals. The judges appointed an attorney to represent Ruth at sentencing. He cites his client's mental health and his age, 60 years old, and is asking the judge for a reduced sentence of 27 years. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Stocks opened mixed this morning after a big sell-off in tech shares yesterday. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 25 points in early trading.
Google's parent company is set to report earnings later today, followed by Amazon tomorrow. Investors are listening for clues about the strength or possible cracks in the artificial intelligence boom. Walmart has joined some giant tech companies, reaching a market value of $1 trillion for the first time. The discount retailer has prospered during a period when more and more families are looking to cut costs when shopping for groceries and other household staples. Federal Reserve Governor Stephen Miron has formally quit his job as a White House economist. Miron had been on leave from that post since joining the Fed board last fall. Critics complain that keeping a foot in the White House compromised the central bank's independence. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, stocks remain mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials are up about 40 points. The NASDAQ is down more than 230 points. That's down 1%. This is NPR. The Washington Post newspaper is laying off a significant number of its workers. The paper is closing its sports desk and its books section. Its international desk will shrink dramatically. The local metro section will be restructured. The cuts are coming at the direction of the newspaper's owner, billionaire Jeff Bezos. Senior Washington Post officials say the changes are due to disappointing realities. Super Bowl 60 between the Seattle Seahawks and the New England Patriots will be played Sunday in Northern California. As Steve Futterman reports, the NFL says federal immigration officers will not be part of security for this year's championship game.
As league and law enforcement agencies presented an outline of security activity, the NFL's chief security officer, Kathy Lanier, said one specific federal agency will not take part.
There are no planned ICE or immigration enforcement operations that are scheduled around the Super Bowl or any of the Super Bowl-related events.
The Super Bowl is classified as a significant event by the Department of Homeland Security, and coordination among state, local, and federal agencies takes place every year. DHS, which ICE is part of, is playing a role, but it says ICE is not part of this year's security plans. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in San Francisco.
This year's Best in Show Award of the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show has gone to a Doberman Pinscher named Penny. She outperformed six other finalists to claim the title yesterday in New York. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, envisioning a future where learning sparks opportunity and thriving belongs to everyone. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Last Friday, New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced she'd propose legislation to ban local counties and cities from entering into 287G agreements. These are agreements establishing cooperation between local law enforcement and ICE. But many immigration advocates say it falls short and are calling on Hochul to pass the New York for All Act. We told you a little bit about the governor's proposal. Now joining me on the phone is For the Many's political coordinator, Daniel Atona, to talk about what immigration advocates are asking for. Daniel Atona, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. At For the Many, we're a grassroots organization in the Mid-Hudson Valley, and we have a lot of immigrant members and a lot of members who care a lot about our immigrant neighbors. I myself, the son of an immigrant. And yeah, so we're very, very clear on our demand, which is the New York for All Act. It would completely prohibit New York state and local government agencies, including police, from colluding with ICE, disclosing sensitive information, or diverting personnel or other resources to further federal immigration enforcement. We're also calling for the MELT Act to unmask ICE. And we're really loud and clear about asking state legislators to co-sponsor New York for All and MELT, and for Governor Hochul to pass them unamended before the state budget. So we agree with Lieutenant Governor Delgado that Hochul's proposal is way too weak. Eliminating 287G agreements is not enough, because under her proposal, local law enforcement can still share information with ICE and assist them in abducting, detaining, and deporting New Yorkers. There's some really good reporting from New York Focus about this, which basically covers, they interviewed a police chief in the village of Allegheny in upstate New York, and he basically said that 287G would not prevent anything his department is doing from working with ICE. It would just prevent them from being reimbursed for it.
Yeah, and we spoke with New York Focus yesterday about that and what's in the proposal from Hochul. But for you and other immigration advocates, New York for All has been around for a while. There's support throughout the state. What were your initial reactions to Governor Hochul's proposal to limit this cooperation in this way and not coming fully on board with New York for All?
Yeah, I mean, we're frustrated, right? Because we've been very clear about what we want, and she knows that this bill is there and has been around for a couple of years. It's quickly gaining co-sponsors. I just checked this morning, and it has a couple more co-sponsors than it did the last time I checked. And so, you know, the New York for All has a lot of momentum. MELT Act has a lot of momentum. And so for her to ignore these bills that already exist and to propose her own watered down half measure is really frustrating and disappointing, but unfortunately emblematic of a lot of the stuff that Governor Hochul does, where she takes good ideas and then waters them down and weakens them to please, either corporate donors or conservative voters that she thinks she might be able to win over.
Governor Hochul was on NPR's Morning Edition with A. Martinez yesterday. She was asked about her support for New York for All. Let's play a short clip of what she said from that interview.
Now, I've heard the bill doesn't go far enough. For years, immigration advocates have pushed for New York to pass the New York for All bill, which would provide more protections for immigrants. You do not support that bill, Governor. Why not?
Well, I sat with representatives from the coalitions this morning who gave me a lot of praise for what I did on Friday in recommending this bill. So they thought it was a very positive step. The New York for All Act wasn't passed by our legislature last year. It was passed by one of the two houses. And there's absolutely elements of that that I believe we can find common ground with and get over the finish line. So the conversations are still ongoing.
Governor Kathy Hochul on NPR's Morning Edition with A. Martinez yesterday. How likely do you think the bill will pass this legislative session? And what makes this year different? Why do you think she's confident?
Well, Governor Hochul is smart enough to know that if she were to get behind New York for All, it would immediately pass the state assembly where it's been held up. And so, you know, her not supporting it and her proposing this half measure is actually what is blocking New York for All from happening. She's trying to disguise the fact. She's trying to disguise her role in this and try to shift blame onto the legislature. And obviously, we are frustrated that the assembly has not passed New York for All yet. But she can't completely shift blame away from herself because she has a major role to play because she is a major power player in Albany, right? And so for her to kind of pretend that, oh, this isn't really on the table because the legislature hasn't passed it, you know, that's just not an honest statement from her. She had the ability to put it on the table and get it passed literally this week if she wanted to. And so she should listen to the assembly members and senators who more and more every day who are co-sponsoring bills like New York for All and Melt Act, because we don't want our state and local governments colluding with ICE. We don't want ICE to be masked in our state. We don't want ICE in our state at all. Like, something For the Many is very clear about is that we want to abolish ICE. They are a reckless rogue agency that is literally executing people on the streets in broad daylight. They aren't making anyone safer. They've only existed since 2003, so we really don't need them. Justice for Renee Good and Alex Preddy, abolish and prosecute ICE.
And if, on the New York for All Act, why do you believe it's the strongest way to guarantee the safety of immigrants? How does it meet the current moment?
Because it's the most comprehensive in terms of preventing state and local government officials, including police, but also all the other departments of local government, from turning information over to ICE or turning people over to ICE. You know, people should have a sense of safety when they're interacting with their local government, knowing that a form that they fill out isn't going to be turned over to ICE, or knowing that if they drop their kid off at school, that they don't have to worry about that. And so, you know, we just don't want any element of our government here in New York State coordinating or cooperating or colluding with ICE in any way whatsoever. And the New York for All Act is the most comprehensive way to address that. Hochul is basically taking one very small piece of the bill, like 10% of the bill, and then trying to pass that off as a major legislative victory. And that's just not acceptable.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with For the Many's political coordinator, Daniel Otona, about how he and other immigration advocates feel that Governor Kathy Hochul's proposal to limit cooperation with ICE falls short and is pushing for the governor to pass the New York for All Act. You mentioned For the Many in the Hudson Valley. Locally, there's a growing fear about the possibility of an ICE facility coming to Orange County there in Chester. What are you hearing from immigrants in the Mid-Hudson Valley about a possible growing ICE presence in the region?
Yeah, people are really scared, right? ICE has already been here in the Hudson Valley. We've seen them. We filmed them. We're tracking them. But this new proposal to build a massive detention center in the village of Chester that ICE is saying will hold 1,500 people, but we all know that they're going to be packing 2,000, 3,000 people in there if this gets built. You know, this is a really dangerous proposal that's almost unanimously opposed by people all across the Hudson Valley. It would be very hard to find someone in Hudson Valley who supports this proposal. ICE is proposing building this, and so we're calling on Orange County to do everything it can to fight the proposal. The state government, we need their help to fight this proposal. We cannot let ICE build a detention center here in the village of Chester. We don't want them building a detention center anywhere. And something that I keep really emphasizing is, so where they're trying to build it is in a Pep Boys warehouse that's owned by the billionaire Carl Icahn. He's a Trump advisor. It really isn't a coincidence that there's a billionaire in the White House and a billionaire who owns this warehouse that could be turned into an ICE detention center, and that they're working together to try to crush working class immigrant New Yorkers. This is a war, the billionaire class against the multiracial working class, and we all need to stand up and fight back.
I've been reporting recently about how the Trump administration is buying up these warehouses across the country. There are a couple of them have closed in Pennsylvania, I believe. This one is still proposed. Again, you know, how do you plan to build momentum in New York for the New York for All Act to get this passed in the state legislature this year?
Yeah, I mean, as always, it's got to be a multi-pronged strategy, right? Like, we need the protests to continue. I was at a very large protest, 700 people outside of Chester Village Hall. We had 300 people in the freezing cold in Newburgh. That was a protest that was co-sponsored by For the Many and Mid-Hudson Valley DSA. And we were out there protesting against ICE, calling for legislative solutions like the New York For All Act. And so, you know, the protests need to continue. You know, the grassroots advocacy needs to continue, you know, lobby meetings, calling your state legislators, calling the governor, right? Setting up meetings with your state legislator, meeting with them in person and talking about how important New York For All is. You know, we need to be talking to our friends and family and neighbors about how important it is to get involved. There's going to be a huge mobilization to Albany on March 10th to call for New York For All. So, you know, we really need people to get involved in all the different ways. You know, only through our people power, people coming together, is how we're going to get this through and that we're going to overcome Governor Hochul's attempts to water down New York For All.
How can folks stay plugged in to For the Many's efforts and learn more?
Yeah, I mean, if you go to forthemany.org, you can learn more about our organization. And yeah, hopefully we'll see you up in Albany on March 10th. But yeah, we have offices in the cities of Kingston, Newburgh, and Poughkeepsie doing grassroots community organizing, community meetings, talking about different state and local legislation and ways that we can stand up and fight for our neighbors.
For the Many's political coordinator, Daniel Atona, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, Governor Josh Shapiro made his case to lawmakers yesterday. Spotlight PA Capitol reporter Stephen Caruso joins us with reaction from inside the chamber. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
So Brett was standing on a subway platform, sees a stranger walking from person to person, saying to each one, "You, you're in. You, out. You, you can stay." The guy's not violent, doesn't make anybody actually leave, but silly as it sounds,
I found that you can't help but kind of hope that he gives you the thumbs up when your turn comes.
That and other stories about the kindness of strangers this week on This American Life.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, a 2019 conversation with Meg Wolitzer, hosted by The New Yorker's Adam Gopnik. They'll talk about some of Wolitzer's most celebrated books, including The 10-Year Nap and The Female Persuasion. Wolitzer's best-selling novel, The Wife, was made into a movie starring Glenn Close. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro addressed a joint session of the General Assembly at the Capitol yesterday, which you heard here on Radio Catskill. Laying out his vision for the year ahead and the budget, he hopes lawmakers will pass on time. The speech touched on major priorities and set the tone for negotiations that will play out over the coming months. Also at the back, in the backdrop of an election year for the governor, Spotlight PA Capitol reporter Stephen Caruso was in the room for the address, and Radio Catskill's Jason Dole spoke with him afterward about what stood out and what could shape the budget debate moving forward.
I've now done about 7 of these budget addresses. They kind of had a lull during COVID, as all big in-person events did, but this one felt a little bit more like just normal. You know, there's always a ton of special guests, elected officials from all of the Commonwealth, some business leaders. Every single lawmaker gets into one room, or at least, you know, everyone who can make it. They hear the governor speak. It could be for 40 minutes to an hour to, this one was pushing 90 minutes from the governor. And he lays out, it's almost like a State of the Union. You know, we call it a budget address because the focus is supposed to be on what is going to be in this year's spending plan for the state. Where are they going to get the money from and how are they going to use it? But it is turned into, I think, a particular in the longer along I've been, it turns into this statement of statement of priorities. You know, the governor proposed $53.3 billion in spending. That's about a 5.5% increase on last year. There's money for education in there. There's some money for transit. But even though those issues have really divided the legislature in recent years, he kind of like underplayed them, I think partially because they've been issues that, even though where a lot of money's going, that's what led to the biggest issues. And he used the speech to talk a lot about what, you know, you could call it affordability, you could call it abundance, you can call it whatever you want. But some of those hot-button issues that people feel in their pocketbook that I think are driving our politics, housing costs, energy costs, there's some cutting of red tape. He talked about wanting to get rid of leasing requirements, for certain jobs, streamlining laws. And in general, I think he was trying to, you know, focus even less on how we're going to spend the money, because the state does have a structural deficit, but focus on what that money can do for people and what can be done even without spending a single dollar if lawmakers just, you know, work their tail off and come up with some new solutions.
Right. So let's get into some of the subject areas. First off, with housing, what did you hear in housing, and is it going to be enough to address the housing issues in the Commonwealth?
I think that, you know, what we heard from housing is it's really going to come down to how much of housing is going to be dictated by how much money do you spend and how much of it's going to be dictated by the policies on the ground. That's sort of the dynamic we're seeing. The governor talked about a lot of things. He mentioned wanting to cap rents on manufactured homes, slow the rate of growth that they pay to their landlords. That has often been brought up by private equity companies. He talked about sealing eviction records, which would make it easier for people who maybe have been evicted for no cause to, not have that scarlet E on their record. And he also did talk about zoning reform. What can the state do to make it so that people can build, you know, duplexes, triplexes, wherever, add a granny flat onto a home. And those things are, you know, touching on different coalitions. Local government officials might not like touching zoning. You know, landlords might not be a fan of eviction sealing. But, you know, if you're not spending money, that makes it a bit easier, especially with Harrisburg being divided as it is and so much of that divide being about spending. But the governor also pitched about a billion dollar plan, which is by far, I think, one of the biggest single tickets in this, that's going to be based upon not spending money we have, but going into debt, $1 billion in bonds to make a state, he called it a critical infrastructure fund, that's basically just going to be able to spend money on, he pitched housing, energy, schools. I imagine it would depend a lot on the language there. And two things, you know, which one matters. If the governor, there's some reporting from my colleague that he might be looking more at wanting to use money as an incentive to get local governments that might be opposing more dense housing, just more housing writ large in their communities to come along. That sort of move is concerning to some housing development advocates who think that that'll just let the communities, especially the wealthier communities that like being the way they are and, you know, maybe engage in some exclusionary zoning, but do what they want because they don't care how much money the state's going to throw at them. They're, you know, they have a tax base for it. And, you know, you need to do some top-down management on land use is something you hear. The governor didn't pick a side on that. It's clear he's kind of willing to work with carrots and sticks, but that's kind of the dynamic I'm really going to be watching when it comes to housing.
Oh, that's interesting. That's great. Another issue, the issue of affordability popped up, and not necessarily in as many words, but it seemed like he kind of pointed the blame back at the federal level and then dove into some things specifically about health care, noting that nearly 500,000 Pennsylvanians are seeing their health insurance premiums double this year. And he blamed Congress mm-hmm. for that and noted that, and this is relevant for us covering Northeast Pennsylvania, the communities hardest hit are in rural communities. Did you notice instances of him talking about kind of like the affordability for folks on the ground, the prices that they're facing, whether it was for health insurance or other things?
Yeah, I mean, I would say energy was one he talked about a lot, and that makes sense. You know, Pennsylvania is a huge energy-producing state. We have natural gas. We even, you know, we still have some coal. So that's to say, like, he talked a lot about, though, not so much how it's produced and carbon emissions, but that where do ratepayers feel it? You know, when we flip on our lights, then we get our electric bill at the end of the month, how high is it? He had said that he had, the governor has been, you know, working with the Trump administration and other Northeast governors to try to get their hands around PJM, which is the grid that connects, power plant operators with the utilities who distribute it to our homes, to try and clamp down on those prices, keep them lower. I mean, a lot of that's being driven by data centers, which is, you know, another separate issue, is a big problem. And there hasn't been as much conversation about, like, you know, no one seems to be saying, at least at this point, that the state should be straight up building power plants. So, you know, we have a private market there. So what I'm trying to get at is, like, you know, this is a supply and demand issue. And when you talk to a lot of experts who look at this, the problem is just that, like, data centers suck up a lot of energy, and there's not a lot of, and if the more energy they take, the less energy there is for, you know, everyday folks, and they have to pay more. So with that said, you know, that's something the governor has been very willing to work with the Trump administration on. That was something that Trump, you know, convened a bunch of governors. They signed an accord on this. He actually kind of gently chided Republicans in the legislature when they didn't applaud him for saying he met with the Trump administration about that. So that's been a big affordability thing the governor has leaned into. I think, again, there's going to be a lot of debates over, like, what happens, you know, how do you spend money on that versus how do you just make some policy changes? You know, the, like, utilities are powerful. And again, I would point out there is that supply and demand dynamic. The governor did suggest some more rules with data centers, more transparency, more environmental standards, trying to convince them to, you know, build their own power stations and, or, you know, bring more power technology or more just power onto the grid with them to not take energy that could be used to power people's homes. But, you know, I would say that was a big thing. The governor talked a little bit about health care. You know, he also did suggest he would make a $100 million state fund to try and respond to the federal government if, you know, help with, you know, sudden changes in federal policy. But let's just be very honest. When federal funding is, you know, potentially like $45, $50 billion a year to the state, obviously not all of that's threatened by the Trump administration right now, but $100 million is pennies on the dollar. So, you know, I look at that as more of a – it would give the governor a chance to maybe pick some politically astute fights that can make him look good or make Democrats look good or, you know, whoever wants to be on his side look good. And, you know, and I'm not saying that wouldn't help people in the process, but, you know, there's really no replacement for if the federal government just completely, you know, cuts its obligation to the state, which is, again, something the governor did talk about a lot, but there's really no replacing it. It's the federal government, you know.
I think, you know, he's got to look for, on the politics side of things now, I think he's got to look for those opportunities for some easy, to get in some easy hits, some political hits in there, because so mm-hmm. often he's got to balance at least two sides often on a number of issues. The data centers that you were just bringing up is a clear one of those where he's proposing mm-hmm. this grid approach, really emphasizing, like, you know, standards, but also talking about, again, that efficiency of making things happen quicker if they're going to happen while putting, you know, some standards in place and saying, hey, you know, you need to provide your own energy. You can really hear him trying to, you know, have it both ways or thread the needle just so he's bringing both sides along.
Yeah, and I mean, data centers is a great example of that. I mean, I see right-wing legislators from rural PA propose things that are opposed to data centers. You see leftist activists opposing it. I'm not putting these ideologies on them to try and demean it either. It's just that, like, that I have seen both sides of the ideological spectrum get up in arms about these things. And governor is, you know, trying to walk this middle line and I think bring as many people as he can. I think in general, new regulations are always something that particularly Republicans are to look askance at. The industry might look at askance at. So, you know, how you walk this path is difficult. And then, you know, you have to get it through our General Assembly, which is, you know, divided between both parties and, you know, has oodles of special interests with lots of cash to throw around. So it's not easy, but, you know, he's trying. And I think there will be a big push from people to be also, though, like, how much of this effort is, you know, what are the pros and cons of the governor's effort? You know, there are some people who might, you know, might be concerned about this, but also might not be a fan of some half-hearted reforms, too. And so I'm expecting this push-pull to really dominate it. And I should add, too, though, just speaking of political, you know, gamesmanship, the governor is up for re-election this year. So are, you know, all members of the state House, currently controlled by Democrats, and half of the Senate. So there's going to be a whole lot of that on every issue that the governor talked about. This, like, both how do we get policy wins this year, and then how do we, you know, see what we can turn into a campaign hit? Come on.
Given that political reality, not just for the governor, but also for folks sitting there in the legislature, it seems to me that it would be in everybody's interest to get this budgeting process done with much quicker than last year. And then that's kind of where the speech ended. That was the first time I really heard the governor acknowledge how long that it took. But the big theme of the ending of his speech there was essentially, let's work together, a sense of togetherness.
Yeah.
He said, you know, let's pass this together. Together is the operative word. We've shown what's possible when we all work together, even when it takes longer than it should, referencing what happened with the budget last year. He said it took too long, but we learned some valuable lessons. Is this talk about lessons learned from last year's budgeting process and just general talk of togetherness, reaching out across political divides? Is it just positioning? Is it just talk? Or is there some hope that this might actually turn out this way?
Well, look, the governor said that he invited all of the leaders to meet in his office tomorrow and talk about this budget and talk about negotiations. And both parties to that, Republicans and Democrats, confirmed they're doing it. I'm going to be in Harrisburg tomorrow. I'm going to keep an eye on that. So that's going to be the first real tell. I mean, my time being up here, I always remember the folks who are in the know basically saying like, oh, you know, budget talks don't really start in earnest until June. So having everything actually people meeting all four parties, the head honchos in rooms together in February is a big deal. Like that is something that I think one can celebrate. Now, if that leads to a result again is a separate question. You know, I think that there's always going to be an element of political theater to any sort of public negotiation, which is what budget talks are, particularly the coming weeks when there's going to be budget hearings. And there's always going to be a matter of positioning, people talking tough just to like set the terms early. I you know, in terms of the budget actually being done by June 30th, the deadline, I think it's possible. I actually talked to Kerry Benninghoff. He's a former House Majority Leader, so he's negotiated a couple of these things before, and he felt more optimistic just because it is an election year, as you said. Like, people don't want to be in Harrisburg haggling over decimal points. People want to be out on the campaign trail making sure they come back to Harrisburg. You know, and again, there's a lot baked into that assumption that I'm sure folks could quibble with, but that's definitely the attitude in the building.
We're talking to Stephen Caruso, a Capitol reporter for Spotlight PA, and we'll definitely be talking to you again, Stephen, as we get into this budgeting process, and I'll be really interested to hear what you are seeing in Harrisburg. But I thank you so much for being here with us on this very busy day.
Thanks for having me. Happy to talk.
Jason Dole speaking to Spotlight PA Stephen Caruso just after Governor Josh Shapiro's address to the General Assembly yesterday in Harrisburg. Coming up, from power outages to severe storms, what New York State wants residents to know before the next emergency, and how to get free training to prepare. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we're talking to James Beard Award winner Muhammad Abdul-Hadi about Philadelphia's Down North Pizza, a restaurant that's slanging pies and saving lives. Literally. Find out more coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As extreme weather, power outages, and other emergencies become more common across New York, state officials are putting renewed emphasis on something simple, making sure residents know what to do when things go wrong. The New York State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services runs the Citizen Preparedness Corps, a free training program designed to help individuals and families prepare for disasters before they happen. There's a training coming up in Roscoe this Friday. I spoke with Maria Fiegel of the Citizens Preparedness Corps about why preparedness at home matters now more than ever.
The Citizens Preparedness Corps training began in February of 2014 after the impacts of Superstorm Sandy. This was a governor's initiative to teach people how to prepare for disaster and other emergency situations. It's actually one of our most forward-facing and innovative training programs to reach the public. The course includes information about the types of risks and hazards people could face. Participants who come to these trainings learn the steps to developing individual and household plans to prepare for disaster or other emergency. The training also encourages all to think about and save needed emergency supplies, because learning how to help yourself and others in advance will help you react faster when facing a crisis. The class is conducted by the National Guard, and it lasts approximately an hour and a half. At the end of the training, each family that attends receives one preparedness kit, which contains some examples of some items which could be helpful in an emergency and might actually be included in their family emergency kit. They'll also receive checklists and other materials to help them craft an individual and household preparedness plan.
We've certainly seen increases in extreme weather events and natural disasters in recent years. How does this preparedness training help individuals and communities better respond to these challenges?
Well, in an emergency, time is of the essence. Prepared individuals are more likely to respond calmly and effectively. So this program gives residents tools and resources to prepare for any type of disaster, respond accordingly, and recover as quickly as possible. This, in turn, can help make citizens more resilient, and it also allows emergency services to better utilize resources and focus on the most dangerous situations, knowing that the citizens are already more prepared individually.
I think what's great about this training as well is that it doesn't just encourage participants to prepare for themselves, but to help neighbors and other vulnerable populations in their community. Talk about how that training encourages folks to prepare for others.
Well, we all need each other, right? In an emergency, our most vulnerable populations become even more vulnerable. Participants who are trained and feel prepared, who have a solid plan for their own families, then have the ability to reach out and assist others more easily. The training encourages participants to reach out, check on family, neighbors, and friends that may need more assistance when a disaster happens.
What are some of the most common misconceptions people might have about emergency preparedness? I know that during weather emergencies, especially this winter, we tell people on air, you know, make sure you have a flashlight in your car and take care of your pets. And people may not think it would impact them. You know, how does the CPC training help correct that?
Well, we saw an activation. We were in full activation here at the State Emergency Operations Center. Most people believe that they're more prepared than they actually are. Or if they've been through a disaster before and they're not impacted, they think nothing will happen to them. They were fine the last time. Or they might think that they can wait it out and help will come and rescue them if they need it. Unfortunately, emergencies happen suddenly. That's what makes them emergencies, right? And right. Sudden storm or flood or situation can affect an area without much warning, necessitating a quick evacuation or some sort of quick action. So this training covers that. Just because you might think you've been through a disaster before and not had problems doesn't mean you won't be impacted in the next storm or event. Mm-hmm. Residents should always follow the instructions provided by the officials, but as you know, people don't always follow directions. The training also covers that during emergencies, those local town and county resources can quickly be stretched thin. Individuals can quickly be isolated. Rescue and assistance may take time. If someone waits too long, it may not be possible to get assistance to them, and recovery may take even longer. So by being prepared for many of the needs of your household in an emergency, you can survive a major disaster, and you can also help your neighbors to do the same.
I laughed because I think I was one of those people that thought I was more prepared than I really was during this last snowstorm, thinking I could just drive out of my driveway the next morning when I realized, oh, I'm stuck. I'm not prepared. So this training does.
That's absolutely true. Most people think they are way more prepared than they actually are. So that's what this training does. It actually makes you think about what kinds of things you're going to need for your family, for yourself.
Yeah, talk about that. How do you make it practical and relevant for everyday New Yorkers?
Well, in an emergency, vital resources can be a challenge, such as communications, transportation, heating, cooling, power, water. This training uses real-life examples, many from situations that have actually happened in New York. The CPC, or the Citizens Preparedness Corps, helps each person be prepared in a practical way and encourages them to think about their own particular risks and needs and the needs of their family. So everyone thinks, run to the store and get bread and milk beforehand, right? But what about everything else after? How will you make those purchases? Will your credit cards work if the power's out? Another example might be planning for something as simple as drinking water. Do you know how much you need per person per day in your house? How do you store it best? Foods are the best to have available. All the way down to, how will you communicate when there's no power? How will you get medical needs met, vital prescriptions, medical records, even identification? Can you work your job without Wi-Fi? What about pets? This program hopefully inspires citizens to take an active role in getting themselves ready, but it actually asks these questions so that people will begin to think more clearly.
What kind of feedback have you received from folks who have taken the training?
Oh, my goodness. We have had a tremendous response to these trainings. We regularly hear from training participants that this training helped them be less fearful, more confident, that they would actually be prepared in an emergency. Also, we get comments about how useful it is. They're going to encourage their family and friends to take a training. And after an event, we often receive additional requests for training because everyone wants to have one in their neighborhood. We also have several host locations that schedule additional events in advance because they feel the training is important and they want to provide it on a regular basis.
You have a training coming up locally at the Livingston Manor Roscoe Branch Library. That's Friday at 5. Registration is required, I understand. Can you give folks more information about that event, where to register? And if they can't make that event, you have them all over, right?
Yes, we have them all over. They're open to the public, so especially the bag events. Participants can register by going to www.newyorkprepare.gov, which will take you to the CPC page or Citizens Preparedness Corps page, where you'll find a link to attend trainings as well as a video and some other helpful preparedness materials. If you live in the Roscoe area, you can also contact the Livingston Manor Roscoe Public Library, and they can assist in getting you registered. Like I said, all of our training events are open to the public, and a list of upcoming events can also be found by going to newyorkprepare.gov or just simply searching Citizens Preparedness Corps. Put that in your browser, and it'll bring you right to the Citizens Preparedness Corps web page. Events are added weekly. We're constantly scheduling new events. So if you can't find an event in your area right now, please check back. We also have a Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram account, so you can follow us and keep, you know, updated on what's going on. We'd love to have more New Yorkers at one of our events.
There's also information at the Livingston Manor Library website about that one coming up in Roscoe, lmr-library.org. Maria, before we go, what is one simple piece of advice you would give to someone who's really never thought about emergency preparedness before today, or like me, thought maybe they were prepared?
Well, first I'd like to ask you, or everyone, why aren't they prepared? And then I would like to quote a very wise man, Benjamin Franklin. He said, by failing to prepare, you're prepared to fail. Finally, I think I would encourage everyone to come to one of our CPC trainings to learn why and how to prepare for an emergency so you can feel safe and you can feel prepared and you can do your part for your friends, your community.
That's Maria Flegel from the New York Citizen Preparedness Training Program. More information at prepare.ny.gov. Maria, thank you so much.
Have a great day.
Coming up, yoga, art, music, and meditation all under one roof in Ellenville. We'll talk with the creators of Juniper ahead of their grand opening. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
Russia's hybrid warfare against Europe has increased sharply since the country's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 4 years ago. Attacks are becoming more dangerous.
These attacks are getting more visible because Russia is really trying to influence the general population.
I'm Juana Summers. Russia's attempts to undermine support for Ukraine in Europe on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen to All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Juniper is a new cultural and wellness center opening its doors in Ellenville, a space designed for creativity, connection, and care. From yoga and meditation to music, art, and after-school programs, Juniper aims to bring people of all ages together around well-being and community life. This Saturday, Juniper celebrates its grand opening, and joining us now are co-founders Adrian DiMatteo and Cassie Luzinski to talk about the vision behind the space and what they hope it can offer in Ellenville. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you for having
us. So tell us a little bit more about Juniper. Paint the picture. What's the space? How did this come about?
Yeah, Juniper is a picture that is being painted as we speak, all of us together. It is a very community-focused vision, and what that means is that we're bringing our experience, we're bringing our background, and our people-focused mission of bringing art classes, music, all of the education that we have. We're both 500-hour certified yoga teachers, and we are working with a network of really talented, amazing people. But the other half of the equation is the people who are going to walk through our doors, their needs, their interests, what they envision for their community. And we've been living in Ellenville for years, and it's a place that I call home. So we are here to serve.
Yeah, mentioning Ellenville, it's seen a lot of change over the years. Why did it feel like the right place for Juniper to take root?
Yeah, we've been looking for a place to kind of ground all of the offerings that we have and our friends have. And there's a lot of, you know, happening places all around the Catskills, but we live in Ellenville and we really just wanted to serve the people in the community that we live in. And the space opened up and it was just, you know, the right time and it was the right place. So,
was there a particular moment that sort of sparked this idea? How did it come together? Or did you notice a need in the community?
We've noticed a need in the community. I think that a lot of people in the region are aware that there are some issues in Ellenville when it comes to low income, when it comes to drug issues, when it comes to a lack of access to resources for just after school programs, for instance. I have been teaching music, for instance, for the past 20 years of my life. And I don't see a music school. I don't see a lot of things that are normally in towns with a little bit more of a financial infrastructure to provide them. So we are there to fill a gap, I think.
You mentioned it's a cultural and wellness center. How do those ideas intersect? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so we have both been traveling the world for a long time. I work directly with indigenous cultures and people from different backgrounds of training, everything from the scientific world to First Nations people. I've traveled to Guatemala, Peru, Ecuador, Israel, Egypt, you name it. We're going to Tibet on pilgrimage to study with the Tibetan tradition in July, which there's spaces available if people want to come with us to Tibet. And so all of this cultural exchange has informed a lot of our work. And the principles of wellness, especially through the lenses of ancestral traditions, are a huge part of what we're helping to bring forward and create a platform for that. So Juniper also has fair trade products available in the store from these cultures, as well as musical instruments from all over the world. So they intersect very heavily.
You mentioned musical instrument and your world travels. You showed me your Peruvian flute that you brought along.
Yes.
Can you describe that to listeners?
Yeah. So the flute of love, the flauta del amor, is a two-sided bamboo flute handmade by a master craftsman in Peru. And one side symbolizes the masculine and one side symbolizes the feminine as principles which are innate to all of us. This has nothing to do with man or woman per se. And so the sound of the flute together is about mutual support and balance. And that's kind of what you breathe into this flute, what they call the breath of love, munai. And so you can't just play it as a musical instrument. You also have to bring consciousness to the act of playing it. So if you'd like to hear it.
I was just going to ask, do you mind sharing some
yes.
of that with us?
And wherever you're listening from, all you have to do is think of someone or something you love and send that energy to them. And I would also invite, if there's someone you feel like you love a little bit less right now, maybe that's the one to send it to. So to the sound of the flute of love.
beautiful. We could all use that. Maybe we should just do that for the hour.
We do that in the form of a sound bath. So come by to one of our sound
baths.
Brilliant.
You talk about your mission centering on community life as well. I mean, that's in your mission. And you talk about a flourishing community. What does that actually look like? To explain that a little bit more.
So for us, a flourishing community life is not just people living in isolated houses, living in isolated apartments, going to the store on their own in their isolated cars. And we are, you know, let's use the metaphor of an ant colony. We're all putting a thread in this weaving. We're all responsible for something. And if we feel like we're alone in that, and we feel like we don't have connections that are deep, you know, the family is meant to be a form of community. But there's a beautiful proverb in ancient Chinese culture. And it says, when there is light in the soul, there is beauty in the person. When there is beauty in the person, there is harmony in the home. When there is harmony in the home, there's honor in the nation. And when there's honor in the nation, there's peace in the world. So we believe that the work that we're doing is helping people to get in touch with themselves deeply inside, their own inner communion with their mind, their heart, their body, to bring all of that into balance. And naturally, that starts to radiate to the people around you in your life, your friends, the strangers that you meet, even the cashier at the store. You start to smile instead of just, hey, give me my, you know. And so together we make a more happy, positive, constructive, solution-oriented world. And the fact is we just can't do it alone. I'm not going to go down the road and build the streets and put up the lights. Somebody needs to do that. Someone needs to take out the trash. Someone needs to. All together we make it happen. And so community is human. And we really just are trying to create more awareness of that and more opportunities to participate in flourishing community life. This includes also the creating of a community garden that's on the horizon for the springtime. Teach people how to grow food at home for themselves. Bring the kids from the schools to learn about agriculture, nutrition, things that are just essential.
You also emphasize safety, respect, inclusivity, and your values. You're rooted in the Hudson Valley, rooted in the Catskills, Allenville, your home. Talk about how nature and the landscape also sort of influences what you guys do there too.
Yeah, so we live up on the mountain in Allenville, and it's a really important part of life, right? Connecting with nature. And through some of our initiatives, like, you know, the food growing, getting people to come back in touch with that aspect of themselves is really important, because it's part of our overall well-being. It's not just, you know, going to the coffee shop and, you know, getting stuck in the material world. It's getting back in touch with the natural side of the world and remembering to go outside and honor, you know, the morning and feel the sun on our face. And right now in the time of year, feel the cold. Mm-hmm. And remembering some of those simple practices that used to be known in normal daily life, and getting, you know, reintroducing people to that and getting back in touch with those things.
Appreciating that, right? Let's talk about the grand opening. You told me that you're actually opening today, but it's not the grand opening. You're open, that you've got great teachers there, you said, so you could come and share the vision of Juniper here with us right now. But talk about the grand opening, what folks can expect, and the details around that.
Sure, yeah. We had the soft opening, and then we had the Coalition of Forward-Facing Allenville with us last night, a collection of business owners from the region. Today we have yoga class, and an art after-school arts program begins today at 4 p.m., but officially Saturday, opening our doors at 6 p.m., welcoming people, introductions, and then we're going to have a cacao celebration. And for those of you who don't know, cacao is the main ingredient in chocolate, and it originates from the Amazon basin, and it's spread throughout the Americas and now around the world. But cacao in its pure, unprocessed form is a superfood. It has a lot of benefits mentally, emotionally, physically, and for many people spiritually as well. So for us, it's just a way of saying thank you, welcoming the community, opening our hearts, singing some songs, playing together, getting to know each other, and really planting seeds for what is going to come to grow in the space. So anyone who comes to the space, you're going to be part of that seed and what's going to come to life from that. And we want you to feel like you're a part of it.
What would that growth of that seed look like maybe a year from now for Juniper, for you? And what do you hope folks take away from this? And if they were to make it part of their routine, what do you kind of hope this is giving them?
Well, I think that our hope is to prove our concept by really having people coming and benefiting and doing it. And that means spreading the word to the parents and to the children that they have a place that they can come. spreading the word to people who may be really struggling and suffering right now through all of the uncertainties of life and society, and knowing that there are tools, that this is not just you're at the mercy of the universe, but that you can learn things, you can practice things. Yoga is deeply beneficial. Diet and nutrition education is essential, and you can transform your life. No, you don't have to wait for someone else to change your life. So a year from now, you know, we'd love to have some more grant funding secured, a steady kind of membership of people that are involved and active, and people bringing their own ideas. We have space rentals and things available too. So if there's something that you want to bring to life, we are accepting event submissions, and it can be a home for your visions as well.
I think that your website address says everything about who you are. Tell people your website address.
Yes, you can visit us at junipertogether.com.
That's great. Juniper, the Cultural Center for Wellbeing and Community Life, tagline, come to gather. Juniper Together. That grand opening is this Saturday in Ellenville from 5 to 9. We're going to go out with a little bit of music. You brought your guitar as well. We've got all the instruments. Thank you so much. You're also a musician, Adrian. Tell us what you're going to play for us a little bit here.
Yes, yes. This song is something that came to me during one of my meditations, and it's a song that just calls upon the inner child, and also for each of us to remember what we're doing as responsible adults to leave a world behind for children for the generations to come. So it's a call to action to be more conscious of what we're creating for the future and to heal that inside of ourselves.
Children calling, way-ah-hey-yo. Hear the children calling, way-ah-hey-yo. Hear the children calling, way-ah-hey-yo. Hear the children calling, way-ah-hey-yo.
Mateo and Cassie Luzinski, co-founders of Juniper, the new cultural and wellness center in Ellenville. Thank you so much.
See you there.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. Colombian actresses Catalina Sandino Moreno, Sasha Calle, and Lina Esco star in the new crime thriller from Netflix, The Rip, alongside some of Hollywood's biggest names.
Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, Joe Carnahan, I mean, like, it's such a great group of people.
That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, some sun and clouds mix today. The, quote, warm weather continues, a high of 27, a partly cloudy tonight, low of 6. Snow and some heavier snow squalls can impact travel later in the weekend. It will get colder for the weekend. Tomorrow, partly sunny, 27, 25 Friday with snow in the evening, up to an inch.